Second, tune your radio to the Conelrad stations, either 640 or 1240 kilocycles. Listen carefully to the instructions. Your life depends on how well you follow them. Do not use the telephone. Third, assemble your family. If your children are at school, they'll be cared for. Or if there's sufficient time, they'll be sent home. People who are at work will either go home or to a shelter provided for them. Fourth, know how to store and purify water. Tightly capped jars of water will stay palatable for about 3 months. Replace the water regularly. Canned water also is available. Fifth, know what foods to store and how to prepare them. Your shelter's provisions should emphasize high concentration of food value rather than volume. It should preserve well, and it should be easy to prepare. Foods canned in metal or glass will stay in good condition for 6 or more months if kept in a dry, cool place. Use small cans. You'll have no refrigerator to store leftover food for another meal. You'll need a canned heat stove. Have plenty of fuel for it. Sixth, know how to dispose of human wastes. Seventh, know how to decontaminate. And eighth, make sure that some member of the family knows the fundamentals of first aid and have a first aid kit in the shelter. Be alert. Stay alert. Then your chances of living longer are multiplied 1,000-fold. Turn this record over and learn why a shelter program may save your life.
You are tuned into basically CITR, a memorial for trans people who have lost their lives. Violence. On unceded traditional Coast Salish Musqueam territory.
There was a memorial organized by Gwendolyn Ann Smith.
We're transitioning
in memory of
documentaries
Rita Hester,
from CITR Docs Season 2. For some context, last year we began an annual documentary series by launching the UBC 100 documentaries. Documentaries using archival audio explore underexplored moments in UBC and Vancouver history. For CITR Docs Season 2, the premise was community. It's a broad topic, and back in May, over a series of many weeks, we released 13 documentaries from 11 producers. You can find them all available now if you go to citr.ca/docs, or you can go to stitcher.ca or iTunes, look up CITR Docs, you'll be able to find them all here. But if you want to stay tuned in, we've got two documentaries for you now. The one you'll hear later on in this hour is from James Mangy and Laurence Gatineau. Based around a series of interviews they did with Gennardy O'Sullivan, it's a look at the current challenges of reconciliation with Canada's colonial past, the inability to reach reconciliation without talking about Canada as an existing and current colonial state, and their 30-minute documentary is the result. What's coming up now is from Josh Gabbert-Doyon, and it's called Some Stories About Chinatown Tunnels.
Having trouble finding affordable fresh baked goods and coffee? Come down to Agora Cafe located in the McMillan building at UBC. There's also space available to study.
It began when Josh, intrepid journalist that he is, heard something rather curious, long-running rumors of there being tunnels underneath Vancouver's Chinatown, dating back to the early 20th century. So, naturally, Josh went looking, and what he found wasn't necessarily just a story. It's a story about how myth is used, be it to racist or emancipatory means, what myth can mean within a community, how myth can target a community, rewrite its history in a malicious way. And you're about to hear that right now. So without further ado, here is Josh Gabbert-Doyon's Some Stories About Chinatown Tunnels. Stay tuned.
It's Saturday, around noon, and Malcolm Eric Hassan is tending bar at SBC. Malcolm is groggy. Last night there was a show at SBC. This morning there's people skating and coming in and out. About half the room is occupied by this wooden ramp that Malcolm and Andrew Turner, the other co-owner of the bar, built themselves. In its current form, it's a punk venue and a bar that sells cheap banana bread and greasy snacks. I've come to investigate a rumor that I heard a few months ago. The rumor says that there's a network of tunnels that runs underneath the neighborhood, and that the tunnel network connects with SBC. The rumor also says that the tunnels have been around for a long time, maybe 100 years or more. The rumor says that tunnels connect with SBC's basement, and that some dark, maybe even supernatural stuff has gone on down there over the course of their history. Here's Malcolm again. Word of warning, parts of Malcolm's audio here is very, very bad quality, mainly because of the loud hair metal music in the back. It was a bar after all.
Do you have any sense of where they went? Did they went towards the port, or they?
We've been told they go as far as Stanley Park, like that they're all connected.
Oh, wow, unreal.
There are a lot of stories about these tunnels. Deals gone wrong, stuff smuggled in from the port, ghost stories, underground clubhouses and secret passageways to brothels. I heard a story of a priest that came down to the tunnels to do an exorcism and then had a section of it boarded up completely. Here's Malcolm again. A word of warning, parts of Malcolm's audio here is very, very bad quality.
When you guys got the place, it was like, was there anything told you about it, or like, was it just...
And we were told it was used for, like, they used to, like, back in the day, it was an opium den.
Okay.
When they used to use it, when they get raided, too, to go, like, to get out, you know, and then there'd be a hatch. If they got raided, people would go and they'd run, they'd pop up elsewhere.
The entrance to the tunnels is in the bar's basement. SBC is named after the original bar in the same building, the Smiling Buddha Cabaret, that opened in the 50s.
We found like some old glass, like opium bottles. We wanted to even just drill a hole, you know what I mean? And put a pinhole camera, or like one of those little tiny cameras with the light, just to even see how long it is. Is there shit in the way? Is there stuff on the ground?
SBC has had many different lives over the years. The building is nestled right on the edge between Chinatown and the downtown east side. And history matters in a place like this, especially Chinatown, because gentrification here depends on ideas about what history should look like. Chinatown is in the middle of a massive redevelopment effort, and it's been going on for a few years. Most of the time, it's the city planners who control what historic Chinatown looks like and what parts of history should be remembered. There are fancy red lampposts and decorative dragons that were installed a few years ago, and that's probably the best indication of the city's vision. Condos have been shooting up like weeds in Chinatown, so have fancy retail storefronts. Like the city planners, real estate developers go for a very vague history of Chinatown, or no history at all. When I first heard about the tunnels, it felt immediately like there was something to the story, because the tunnels aren't so easily mashed in with how the city and how developers want the neighborhood to look. SBC is just one of the places where the tunnels connect. They're not at the forefront of the fight against gentrification or anything, they're just a bar. But they haven't cashed in and turned into a fancy cocktail place or anything. They have their own weird, kind of gritty backstory that comes with the building.
It was kind of like a dine and dance. You know, you could bring your own bottle, it was sort of like a speakeasy, you kind of had to hide it under the table.
That was in the 1950s, when a big red and green neon sign of a smiling Buddha used to hang outside the entrance. It was opened by Harvey Lowe, a world yo-yo champion and local radio broadcaster who had become a prominent figure in Vancouver's Chinese business community.
Well, yeah, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Jefferson Airplane.
My hair was.
Yeah. Jimmy's uncle used to be in the house band here. His story is when his uncle got too drunk, like Jimmy would be here and put on his uncle's blazer and hat and then play for him. And then they eventually kicked him out for being too loud.
And then in the late 70s and early 80s, it was a major part of Vancouver's punk scene, hosting bands like the Subhumans, DOA, Art Bergman, and the Dishrags.
Like, neighborhood people come here and tell stories about being in here, it being like crazy violent. You know, the punks took over, like 78 to 83.
Malcolm and Andrew reopened SBC 3 years ago. And before it was a bar with a half pipe, it'd been sitting empty for nearly two decades.
But even the old owner threatened to kill us. Like, literally uttering death threats. We had to go to court. They got thrown out. And we didn't, the crown...
Malcolm tells me that it had been a drug den in the mid-90s, and then fallen into disrepair. Over its lifetime, the building has had a huge part in Vancouver's nightlife history. SBC has managed to reinvent itself, but also to preserve that history in the process. Which is cool, because as the neighborhood gets primed for gentrification, Chinatown's history often gets forgotten about.
Like, we don't know what's down there. It could be, you know what I mean? Like something, it could be dead body, it could be whatever. Not that there is, but like, then we're down for business.
I wanted to find out more about Chinatown, so I met Vincent Tao, the librarian at the Chinatown Art Space 221A.
It's in crisis right now. It's sort of depressing to walk around the streets because, of the looming condo towers and knowing that essentially people's lives are just going to be, like, they're going to be evicted very soon. So
we go to Chinatown Plaza for lunch. I have shrimp with egg sauce.
There's Chinatown Plaza. This is a city-owned mall. Yeah, it's sort of utopic in the sense that it seems to be peacefully, economically stagnant.
Right. The neighborhood was formed in 1886.
Yeah,
when Chinese laborers, a lot of them ex-railroad workers, settled in the area. This was about a year after the Canadian government had put in place a head tax specifically targeting Asian immigrants. In 1907, an anti-Asian race riot broke out. There's been other flashpoints of racism in the neighborhood's history as well. But despite this, Chinatown turned into a vibrant working-class community with some of the city's most popular restaurant and nightlife spots.
It's a pretty embattled terrain, Chinatown, especially like, because it's easy to just sort of understand it as like gentrifiers and old people. But there's like a lot of different interests sort of vying for control of what Chinatown is going to look like.
Vincent does a lot of work with Chinatown seniors, tracking gentrification in the neighborhood and its effects on Chinatown's most vulnerable residents.
There's like all these different nonprofits trying to fight to preserve Chinese heritage. Then there's Chinese business owners who are trying to sort of like eke out their share of the market in Chinatown. And then there's like, new sort of investors, like the condo developments and all these new retail stores. And then meanwhile, there's the residents, many of whom are like, low income, low cash Chinese seniors and not Chinese seniors, just like people in general. Was actually, my work with Chinatown Action Group, we've been trying to sort of map out the different strands of power that are running through Chinatown. And then trying to find sort of strategic alliances with different people. It turns out everyone's an asshole, just in a different way. Because like, you talk to the Chinese business owners and they're like, we don't like poor people, but we like Chinese people and we want Chinese business, but we feel bad about this new money coming in, but we need to welcome it in order to revitalize Chinatown. And then so there's a tension between preserving heritage, but also like economic revitalization. And what does not come in that tension is like, are the concerns of the people actually living there, right?
The current revitalization efforts, rezoning, and new developments comes on the heels of rising rent rates and Chinatown's newfound reputation as a kind of trendy artist hangout. I asked Vincent about how people relate to the history of the neighborhood.
The use of history of Chinatown, the sort of like imagined history of its sort of ethnocentric sort of development, is presently transforming Chinatown into some sort of like ethno theme park, right? And that's where history is a strange terrain, and as someone working with Chinatown Action Group and Chinatown Concern Group, although the history and the memories of the seniors is something very important to how we like think through our struggle, it's like also not the thing that we want to be reproduced, right? Because there are a lot of hard times in Chinatown, a lot of like terrible living and labor conditions in Chinatown that made it what it is.
So Vincent says there's an aging population of Chinese residents, plus new money flowing in as the working class neighborhood gets redeveloped. Given all this, what do the tunnels mean for the neighborhood? I ask Malcolm of the bar's mysterious basement that's connected with the network of tunnels.
So what are you guys doing with the basement now? You just have storage down there or what?
Yeah. Just storage for the most part.
Can you describe it to me? What is it like down there?
Dirt floors, it's a crawl space, little ceilings.
Like... That's me trying to casually ask Malcolm if I could see the tunnels. Eventually, he catches on to what I'm trying to do.
You're feeling nimble?
I'm feeling nimble today, yeah.
You might get a little dirty.
So Malcolm locks the doors at SBC. He goes back behind the bar and gets a big industrial flashlight. We wait for the skaters and then walk down the center of the wooden ramp to the complete opposite end of the bar. We get up on stage, just covered in gear, and we clear it off.
Yeah, it's just, we gotta get to that.
Malcolm pushes over some stuff at the back of the stage, and then there's a panel on the floor. He unscrews it, he lowers himself in, and we both squirm down this set of wooden stairs. The basement is covered in junk. There are piles of cans everywhere, bicycles, scrap wood. There's wooden rafters right above us, and we can hear people skating on the ramp, and somehow we can still hear the hair metal upstairs as well. The floor is completely unfinished, and there's a plastic covering. And then, in a whisper, Malcolm points it out to me. It's a big, rusted steel door with no handle, no indication, no window, nothing. It's cut into the cinder block. I realize I'm looking at the entryway to what is potentially miles and miles of tunnels under Vancouver. These are tunnels that connect the city with its more complicated past. People that had to stay underground, pushed to the edges of society, lives that aren't written into the city's narrative of Chinatown. It's history that's been covered over. Even the dust down here feels like it's been watching the history of the past 100 years.
And it's facing north.
Yes.
Towards the water.
Yeah.
Wow. Are there tunnels under our feet right now?
No, absolutely not.
That's John Atkins. He's a civic historian and the chair of the Chinese-Canadian Historical Society of British Columbia.
It is one of the most persistent myths found in Chinatowns across North America, and sometimes in Europe, but mostly North America. And every single tunnel reference that you can find when you go and look into it proves to be non-existent.
We're standing in front of the Chinese Cultural Center on the corner of Carroll and Pender, at the point where Chinatown began in 1886.
Occasionally, and I think that's where sometimes people think, ooh, I found the tunnel, is that you might have two businesses that were in similar things, or they might knock a pass through the wall.
But never anything like an extensive network of tunnels.
And why would anybody want to sort of continue or spread the idea of tunnels under Chinatown?
Well, I think it comes from the fact that the Chinese were, when they originally immigrated to North America, were seen as strange, somewhat exotic, and the racism of the period really pictured them as unclean, dangerous, up to no good. Moral reform leagues across North America saw them as corrupting the morals of anybody. Health inspectors here in Vancouver warned housewives not to buy vegetables from Chinese farmers because who knows how they were growing. So there was that sort of racism of the period.
And John thinks the tunnels are bogus. And really, thinking back, I ended up just standing in front of a big piece of steel when I went down to SBC's basement. So maybe there's reason to be skeptical. But more than that, John actually thinks the myth of the tunnels are doing a lot of harm. Remember, anti-Asian racism has always been a looming threat in this neighborhood.
And that's where this idea of the disappearing gamblers, the disappearing whatevers, and it's always underground because we can never see it. But because we can't find it, they're secretive and everything else. And that's where a lot of the myth of this sort of tunnel system comes from, is we can't catch them doing bad stuff. We know they're doing bad stuff. We know it. We just can't find it. And that's really where your tunnel myth comes from.
Do you think that there's a link between the tunnels and gentrification in this neighborhood?
I think as development changes the neighborhood, and that is a real concern here in Chinatown, is what is Chinatown? And how do we perceive Chinatown versus the folks that live and work here? And there's a whole issue around that portrayal. Tourism authorities like to portray Chinatowns as exotic, different slices of the world in their own city. The beautification that you see around you, the red lamp standards, the dragons, all that, that's the outside perception, adding those things to Chinatown, because one city planner said in the 1980s, Chinatown wasn't Chinese enough. And so we're adding those layers to make Chinatown conform to what we think it should be. Tunnels play into that kind of myth-making of the exotic, the secretive, the edgy, we always want something to be more exciting than it actually is. And I think the tunnel myth falls into that category of trying to discover something that's more exciting than what is actually here.
When I look at this, I think what makes me most sad is the fact that the nightlife history of the neighborhood has just become another way to push out residents. And that's the trouble. How can the history of the neighborhood be conserved without buying into the same racist myths that are helping to gentrify the neighborhood today? When I originally heard about the tunnels under Chinatown, I was coming back from a show at SBC, and I was pretty big on the idea of some lost Chinatown history that was getting washed away by gentrification. I'm a white guy that doesn't live in the neighborhood, and ultimately, I just ended up telling another story about how Chinatown was edgy and exotic. It felt like being at an antique shop and looking down to see that you're holding a little porcelain decoration with a racist stereotype painted all over it. Here's Vincent again. For an activist like him, the tunnels represent what could be a really interesting way of thinking about the neighborhood.
Just to leave it as a racist myth is to miss out on what may be like a sort of strategic point to start thinking about. Essentially, how amazing it would be if there were an underground tunnel system underneath Chinatown, right?
So how can the tunnels be put towards supporting the neighborhood and its residents? Likely, it'll involve talking about how the tunnels were just another piece in the story of racism in Chinatown. Despite how extensive the network may be, the myth of the Chinatown tunnels is part of the way a lot of people imagine the neighborhood.
It's sort of like the idea of Chinatown having its own sort of, having its own logic, having its own sort of like almost autonomous relationship to the rest of the city, but also, you know, the idea that that autonomy was forged through social relations that came out of a necessity of racist policy, right? So going underground is a sort of a metaphor for when you're under attack and you need to flee and you need to plan, you go underground, right? And you make connections underground and you build your defenses. And that's how you sort of eke out an idea of autonomy.
So maybe that nightlife history is important. The late night culture, the urban legends, maybe it means that the neighborhood isn't up for grabs. The legacy of the tunnels defies the glass towers and the city's verticality. I think something can still be salvaged from the tunnels, even if we can't get in through the steel door.
Issue of Discorder magazine is out. Grab one right now to read features about accessibility in Vancouver, Western Front's media artist in residence, Gabby Dow, about Gable Vision, the LGBTQIA+ video history archive at Vivo, local thriving 18-year-old hip-hop artist Prado, an interview with the Chinatown Concern Group, Vancouver Latin American Film Festival. Plus, you can cure your FOMO with our concert reviews. Amp up your summer playlist after reading our album reviews. And of course, there's a special taroscope waiting for you in the summer issue of Discorder magazine. Pick one up today at a stand in your neighborhood. Thanks to our advertisers, the Rickshaw Theater, Current Symposium, the Cinematheque, Live Van, the Rio Theater, Audiopile, Rifflandia, and Mint Records.
CITR and BC Black History Awareness present Black History Month. We're featuring stories about extraordinary Black Canadians. One such individual is John Craven Jones, the first teacher on Salt Spring Island. There was no school on Salt Spring Island, so Mr. Jones taught the children wherever there was space, in sheds or in family homes. He traveled back and forth between the schools on the island because it was too dangerous for the children to travel alone with cougars on the island. Jones was one of only 16 public school teachers in the entire province. Most surprisingly, he taught without being paid. The families were happy and eager to ensure he had whatever he needed so that he would stay, providing him with clothing, produce from the gardens, eggs, meat, and poultry. John Craven Jones continued teaching on Salt Spring Island until 1875, when he moved back to Ohio. He taught for another 20 years and then retired as a farmer. This has been a Black History Month PSA from CITR 101.9 FM and BC Black History Awareness.
Are you here because of me? No, I am here because of your light. Planets reach for immortality.
Hello, once again. This is CITR 101.9 FM broadcasting live from unceded Coast Salish Musqueam Territory. We just heard from producer Josh Gabbert-Doyon some stories about Chinatown's tunnels. It's part of CITR Doc Season 2, a season of documentaries about community. And if you want to hear it again, you can go to citr.ca/docs or go to Stitcher or iTunes, look up CITR Docs, you'll be able to find it there too. For our next documentary, this is a 30-minute piece from James Mangy and Lawrence Gatinall. It's called Truth and Reconciliation, and it explores the reconciliation movement right now through one individual, Gnargy O'Sullivan. Its premise is, how can the conversation around reconciliation, decolonization, be authentic when the violence of colonization still continues and persists to this day? Without further ado, please stay tuned. Here is Truth and Reconciliation. Growing up, I was taught that Canada was a colony of Great Britain. I was not taught that the land had been taken from people who already lived here for thousands of years.
Mr. Speaker, I stand before you today to offer an apology to former students of Indian residential schools. The treatment of children in Indian residential schools is a sad chapter in our history. Today we recognize that this policy of assimilation was wrong, has caused great harm, and has no place in our country.
I'm a certain kind of a person, an Aboriginal original, and though some may treat me like a criminal, I've had my chances. Chances my type rarely get. Not to worry. Don't you feel sorry as others appoint their form of punishment to those just like me? Just like me. We're never the same. Our type is different. A mysterious sort. Yet we are a threat. Always have been and always will be. I'm Gnargy O'Sullivan, previously known as Cheryl D. Williams. I'm a part of the 60 Scoop. I'm a part of the foster care system, a product of the ministry, and I am also a residential school survivor and an intergenerational survivor. I've also had to fight to keep my own children in my care, my 23-year-old daughter, Nimkesh, and my daughter, Aisha. So for me, a lot hasn't changed, you know, except for my behavior and my responsibility to my own experiences. I am a radio producer. We've been exploring the residential school era, and now we are talking reconciliation, because that's where we're at. I think I go through different phases when it comes to my identity, simply because of my varied upbringing. Not only am I a residential school survivor, but my mother went to residential school. In fact, her and I went to the same residential school. I started off in 1965, being born in the Alert Bay Hospital. My mother, who had gone to residential school, didn't have the capacity to care for herself or anybody else. She didn't have any parental values or family values because she went to residential school. So she basically gave birth to me and left me there. In 1971 or 72, I met my adoptive parents. And I was telling you a story about that, how I met them in a big house, which is our ceremonial house. There was a cruise ship that used to come into Alert Bay once a week all summer long. And on that cruise ship was a woman, and her name was Kathleen O'Sullivan. Kathleen O'Sullivan was a very eccentric Australian-Canadian. She came here in 1952 for the Empire Games. And she had created this relationship with the people in Alert Bay, the elders and the knowledge keepers, and had encouraged them to hold common dances in their big house once a week. And throughout that time, she grew to love First Nations people along the coast, from the Clinkas to the Kwakiwaks to the Haidas, you name it. She loved us so much, she wanted to be one. That's how much she loved First Nations people. Anyhow, she had wanted to adopt a First Nations child for like a year or two. The elders in Alert Bay knew about her. They trusted her. And when the residential schools were going to be shut down in the 70s, they wanted to make sure that I was placed in a permanent house, that I wouldn't be fostered out. The elders in the community contacted Kathleen O'Sullivan, and they set us up to meet during one of these common dances in the big house, in the Alert Bay big house. And I wandered in with all the other children from the residential school and from the foster care home. And Kathleen was sitting with her husband, Gerald O'Sullivan, Gerard, who's Irish-Canadian. And I guess they were in their 50s or 60s at the time, a little old to be having children. But when they saw, I was wandering in with the rest of the kids, and I was sort of really super shy at the time. And I was kicking up the sand in the big house, following everybody else, and they all gathered around Kathy and Jerry, and they were yelling, "Kathy, Jerry, Kathy, Jerry, candy, candy." And they all had their hands out asking for candy. And when my dad saw me, he turned to my mother, my adopted mom, and said, "Look, we're a little old to be adopting a child, but if it was that little one right there at the end of the line, I would definitely say yes." And that's how I became to be an O'Sullivan. So they went through this transitional period where I stayed at the residential school and visited them for about a year or so. And then I ended up living with them for 2 years. And then when I was 10, my legal adoption went through. I'm a full-blooded Kwakiwak as far as I know, maybe a little bit Haida. But, you know, I didn't want to be Indian. I wanted to be white like everybody else. I wanted those blue eyes, you know, and the blonde hair. And I didn't want the tan that I had.
The government of Canada built an educational system in which very young children were often forcibly removed from their homes, often taken far from their communities. Many were inadequately fed, clothed, and housed. All were deprived of the care and nurturing of their parents, grandparents, and communities.
St. Michael's Indian Residential School was located in Alert Bay, British Columbia, in the northeast part of Vancouver Island. It was opened in 1929 and closed in 1975. In February 2015, Gunarji, along with her partner Gary Olver and her then 9-year-old daughter Aisha, attended a healing ceremony in Alert Bay to commemorate the demolition of St. Michael's.
That building embodies a lot of memories for people. Some of it they can't remember. Their bodies won't allow them to.
Do you think that should have stayed, or do you think you liked it gone?
Well, I think I have mixed feelings about it, because that building is a reminder of the history that the government put upon our people.
That's sort of what I think too. Like, I have mixed feelings. I sort of like it because it's gone, and that sort of like saying goodbye to all of it. But on the other hand, it's like they're just trying to say, okay, we're going to tear it down. You guys are going to forget all about it. Okay, let's go. Move on.
Yeah, because the government doesn't want anybody to remember it. They don't want that evidence for anybody to see because they're so ashamed of it. And they know that what they did was wrong and that it was an act of genocide and it was killing the souls and spirit of our people one by one for generations and generations. And of course they don't want anybody to see it. And they think that if that building's gone and they can't see it, they won't be able to remember it. And 100 years down the road, that evidence will be gone, and that's exactly what they want.
Yeah.
They've managed to ruin a lot of lives.
Yeah. Love you, Mom.
I love you, too. I try to find ways to keep engaged with our culture, and right now I'm really concerned about the dynamics that the residential school, the legacy that residential schools have left us with. We've talked about how we no longer enjoy language and culture, but, you know, we need to explore how language and culture relates to the land. And the reason that is important is because we're in the midst of negotiating our land and land rights and entitlement. And in order to engage in that, we really need to know where we come from, what land base and territory we actually belong to, you know, because we do belong to the land, right? And that's where our ancestors lay, in every blade of grass and every speck of dirt and every leaf and the air that you breathe in that area is where our heart is, and that's where our soul is. And that is why land is so important. It's not about the money. It's about that connection. And I feel like residential schools have done their job and keeping us fractured. When the Oka crisis was happening, there was a lot of racism going on in mainstream media as well as other radio, everywhere. It was fueling a fire of hate towards First Nations people. And I saw that, and that's what drove me, I think, to become the activist that I have become.
The Oka crisis took place between July and September 1990. The dispute involved the town of Oka, Quebec, the Sûreté du Québec, the Canadian Armed Forces, the Mohawk people, and a golf course to be built on traditional Mohawk land.
I was already involved with Co-op Radio. I would try to come to the station to get stuff on the air or news on the air, and sometimes people would say, yeah, by all means, come on in. Others would have more of a tighter format and couldn't really fit us in and things like that. But I started having this urgency, creating, we got to tell people, we have to let everybody know. And that is also, I think, what drives me to do what I do too, right? So what happened was the Oka crisis was happening, and they had a vigilant city down there on Georgia Street, where they had tents up there who were there in support of the Oka crisis. But there was still a lot of anger that was being fueled and racism. And I used to walk past the vigilant camp and see all these people camped out and meeting and drumming and stuff like that. And I would kind of look at it from the outside. And one day, the Fire Hall Theater had put up this big stage in front of Robson Square for their yearly Dancing on Edge Festival. And I went, wow, why don't those people, thinking that I'm not one of them, why don't those people, like, use that stage for something, you know? Like, entertain people with thoughts and support the Oka people that way instead of ranting and raving the way they do. So I went in there and I talked to some people and I said, you know, exactly what I said to you. And they said, oh, you think so, do you? And I said, yeah. And they said, well, why don't you talk to the clan mothers? And I said, clan mothers, what are they? And they said, they're over there in that tent. And they brought me over and introduced me to the clan mothers. I told them what I thought they should be doing and why I thought they should be doing that. And they said, oh, well, if you really think so, why don't you just do it? I was like, really, me? And they were like, yeah, you. I said, no, I can't do that. And they, oh, you can do it. It's your idea, and it's a great idea. And if there's anybody that can do it, it's you. So I did. I called Fire Hall Theater. I asked them if we could borrow their stage and why, and they said, sure, by all means. And we hooked everything up. I can't remember when we did this big event, but it was an all-day event. It went from 1 o'clock till 11 o'clock at night. We were shut down by the police. And that was called a vigilance performance, and we had people from all walks of life who worked in theater, like the Spirit Song Theater Company, and we had Lee Miracle there, Gary Godfredson, who are literary artists. Even Margot Kane came out, and she sang a song. And I never heard her sing before. It was called The Wind Beneath My Wings or something. And so that's when it really, my activism started for me. And actually, that is when I got to full circle where I ended up wanting to be an Indian. Maybe I wasn't totally comfortable in my skin, right? Maybe there was a touch of self-loathing, but at least I wasn't on the wrong side anymore, right? I found my voice. I had tapped into what our struggles were. Instead of going along with people, like, what do you call them, the masses, which is where what I grew up in, instead of going along with what they thought of First Nations people and going along with what I had been brought up with, instead of running around thinking I'm better than them because I'm adopted and then I'm not one of them, That was a turning point for me during the Oka crises. Okay, now I'm one of them, and now I'm fucking mad, right? I went through this thing where I went from walking on the same side as First Nations people instead of why don't you do this? It's why don't we do this, and why don't we do that? I suddenly claimed my identity. But then I went through this period where I didn't like white people very much, and I became racist towards white people, towards immigrants, and all of these things started going around in my head because I was learning about all of the atrocities and how various people played these roles. And then I didn't like religion much either, and I was brought up a Catholic. And I wasn't that comfortable sitting in a circle lighting up sage or sweetgrass. So that's how I lived for a really long time. You know, not really taking either side. I don't want my children feeling hate. It doesn't feel good. It feels better to love and to give and to be gracious, to be giving. And hate just doesn't fly. Doesn't go anywhere. And it's counterproductive at this point. And so I've given up on hate. And I'm back to the center. My activism came out through my art. And that is how I've been portrayed as an activism. And many of us First Nations people, when we write poetry or do a play, it usually has something to do with a struggle that we have gone through. Or say the poem might want to make a statement with that poem. And I think that's been my role, and a lot of the programming that I have done over the years has leaned a little bit more towards activism because that is what is happening in our community. So it's almost impossible for me to be Native and not be an activist and also to work in communication. So that has kind of influenced me a lot. I like to listen to people, and I like to share stories, you know. And I think I'm not the only one. I think that there are a lot of us out there like that, just kind-hearted souls. So I think it's going to take a lot of time on our parts as Canadians when we're thinking about reconciliation. We just have to think with a good heart and just listen. And it doesn't matter whether you're working for the ministry at a radio station or in the educational system. It doesn't matter if you're a gang leader, you're a big dope dealer, whatever it is, you know, at least reconcile with people within your own workplace, you know. And if you're on the street, you know, and you're dealing to First Nations people, maybe not so much, right? Make sure that they're safe, at least if they're addicted. Or if they're working the street, maybe have their backs, you know. I don't know. I'm not trying to promote that either, but wherever you are in whatever walk of life, you know, just stand by First Nations people and get to know them and share your commonalities and some of your differences, you know. And if they do happen to open up to you, for God's sakes, have a listen. Don't be afraid to hear the truth, you know, because if they have for some reason opened up to you, that's something. That's really something. It's not easy. And they chose you to do that. There must be something there, right? Build on that. And you just keep building on it and building on it until you have this common ground and understanding.
While Gunarji's activism focuses on telling stories and communicating with people, her partner, Gary Oliver, thinks more is needed.
Yeah, my name is Gary Oliver, and my last name is O-L-V-E-R. It has no I in it. It's came from I was adopted to a British home. I'm an Aboriginal Canadian from northern Manitoba, from a small little reserve called Moose Lake, but I was born in Nepal. I was apprehended in the 70s, early 70s, and after that point, that's my parents were murdered, and so I didn't have a family to go back to. So even though that my one aunt wanted to adopt me as one of hers, but the government wouldn't allow that. So I ended up in foster care for a little while, and then I was adopted to a very nice British family that raised me right. There was lots of love, taught me from right and wrong, to be educated. But, you know, in itself, it had a lot of struggles, like when it came to spirituality. And, like, my parents were spiritual people, but they were Christians, right? And myself, I understood that, but I always knew there was more to it, right? And that was something they told me themselves. They couldn't teach me that, right? So that was something that I lost out. I've seen the struggles I went through myself, but I've also seen the struggles of other people and other Native people. And, you know, I see where it all stems from. And it's like everybody likes to sugarcoat it and smooth it over and, with about reconciliation. How I look at it is that the government really wants to reconcile with Aboriginal peoples in Canada. We need to get rid of the most racist law that was ever created. And it was like the framework for the African apartheid. And it's got to go. We need to abolish the Indian Act. And, you know, when it comes right down to it, it's the taxpayers that flip the bill. For everything that happens to an Indian person, from being wrongfully incarcerated to apprehending their kids to, you know, calling them a loon or, you know, putting them in a mental institution because, you know, they see spirits. You know, I mean, that's like part of the culture, right? The taxpayers basically are flipping the bill on that, you know what I mean? And it's wrong, and we shouldn't have a law like that in Canada, you know what I mean? It's like we go into other countries to help other people from genocide. So why isn't it our own people are seeing this? You know what I mean? It's everybody's like always complaining that, or our government's no good, or, you know, about all these other problems. But they need to look at it and say, you know what, as a people, we can change a law or abolish a law. Right? Look at France. Every time they have a problem with something, they all protest and they change it. You know, sure, they pay half their net to taxes, but if they ever get sick, they get doctors that'll come right into your home. They take care of you, right? You want surgery? It's done right away. You know what I mean? There's no wait time. So that's kind of how I look at it. It's like, I think as us as a people, I've heard people that are creating sovereignty laws of the indigenous laws of their nations. And I think that's really healthy. And I think the government should push forward to help sponsor these people, to help, you know, those people learn about themselves and their laws. And then later we get rid of the Indian Act and, you know, the reserves would no longer be a reserve. It would be considered a municipality, and there would be no more like little handout anymore that the, what they do now. And then that chief could be considered a mayor, and they could turn to the federal government and ask for, you know, funding for their municipality. And they get a lot more and build infrastructure on those reservations in return. That would put people to work on those reservations and give the young people hope, something to live for, right? It's like you can turn on the news, you know, now and you can see the suicide rates of Aboriginal kids. It's because you go to the reserve and there's nothing there. There's no work. And they just sit around and do nothing, and they get on the internet, and before you know it, they make packs, and, you know, and they do these suicide packs, and it's sick. I mean, they have no hope. So, you know, that all stems again from the Indian Act, right? You know, I think that's something that Canada should open their eyes and look at. You know, it's like, I'm proud to be a Canadian, and I'm proud to be a Canadian citizen. And, you know, I was raised by Canadians and, you know, by a British family. And, you know, I've seen, you know, their point of view. And I've also seen, like, you know, don't get me wrong, I've lived with my own people, and I've seen what they endure. And here I am. It's like I walk that fine line between those two cultures, between being an Aboriginal Canadian and being a Canadian, a non-Aboriginal Canadian, because how I was raised. And I see we can meet down that middle line there, you know, and I think that's what we have to do as Canadian people, and to reconcile the problems that we have here. You know, those laws were created by treaties, okay? And those treaties were signed because we were at war. It's plain and simple, we weren't, right? And it was a war that nobody could win. And that's the reason why treaties were signed. And this day and age, we're not at war, right? And why should that law, why should the law exist, right? We shouldn't be repressed or held back or anything else.
The government of Canada sincerely apologizes and asks the forgiveness of the Aboriginal peoples of this country for failing them so profoundly.
And giving this great gift of communicating my experiences and other people's experiences. I've been given the opportunity to tap into major events that are happening in Vancouver, to grow with a community that has so much to offer, you know, from communications to theater, the performing arts, music, literary arts, you know. We have rappers out there who are all First Nations who never had the opportunity to share their gifts with the world because there was no platform. And that's why I've been so committed to co-op radio and community programming to the extent that I have been. I take it very seriously and always have. We have a lot of work to do, and that's what Truth and Reconciliation is about. It's about that work, and it's work. It's not easy. It's going to take time. It's going to take a lot of patience, a lot of understanding, a lot of listening, and a lot of talking.
Gnarji's poem, Aboriginal Original, is now almost three decades old, and it still resonates.
I'm not mistaken. I'm not mistaken. Some rights for you and no rights for us. Right? Right? Uh-uh. Our questions are alive and so am I, yet you continue to evade what we have to say. Should we all be like you? You, the man who takes all he can from Aboriginal girl to Aboriginal land. Aboriginal girl is still suffering. Mother Earth is hard to find. So, where do you stand? And where do we stand? You're standing on Aboriginal land. So, where do you stand?
This program was produced, recorded, and edited by Laurence Gatinel and James Mingy. Special thanks to Gennarji O'Sullivan and Gary Olver. The audio excerpt on the demolition of St. Michael's School was taken from the short film Demolishing Grief, available on YouTube and used with permission. The drumming you heard in this documentary was performed by the Heiwei Noku Drummers.
Hello once again to the CITR 11.9 FM, broadcasting live from Vancouver on unceded Coast Salish Musqueam territory. You just heard from Laurence Gatinel and James Mangi and Gennarji O'Sullivan, Truth and Reconciliation. It's a part of CITR Doc Season 2, a season of documentaries about community. If you want to listen to any of the 13 documentaries we did for Season 2 or any of the documentaries we did for UBC 100 Docs last year, go to citr.ca/docs. You can find out more about each documentary and the producers therein. You can also go to Stitcher or iTunes, look up CITR Docs, and you'll be able to find all of our documentaries there for free, archival listening, immediate, on your phone, on your web browser, wherever you need it to be. Thank you to the producers for their amazing work. Thank you to CRTC Radio Meters for partial funding of these projects. And thank you for listening. Stay tuned to CITR 101.9 FM. Coming up in a few minutes, we've got Radio Pizza Party. Please enjoy.
Lincoln Alexander was a black Canadian who achieved much in politics. The child of Jamaican immigrants, he served in the Royal Canadian Air Force during World War II. He graduated from the Osgoode Hall Law School in 1953 and practiced at a number of firms for more than a decade. In 1968, he ran in Canada's federal election in the Hamilton West Electoral District. He won and became Canada's first black member of parliament. He served four consecutive terms before stepping down in 1980. In 1985, he was appointed Lieutenant Governor of Ontario, becoming the first black Canadian to hold a vice-regal position. Alexander passed away on October 19, 2012. In December 2013, Lincoln Alexander Day was made a law in Ontario and is held on January 21st. His wife, Marnie Beale Alexander, is currently working to make it a national holiday for Canada. This has been a Black History Month PSA brought to you by CITR.
Hi, you're listening to CITR. My name is Paula, and this is Pride Facts. I'm talking about legislative discrimination against LGBTQ+ people around the world. 73 countries criminalize same-sex activity through legislation. The terminology and the corresponding laws ranges from indecency, buggery, and immorality to against nature. Penalties can be as severe as life imprisonment. So-called propaganda and morality laws that target freedom of expression related to sexual orientation apply to 17 states. The most striking fact might be that in 10 countries around the world, homosexuality carries the death penalty. In contrast, 76 countries and 85 entities have anti-discriminatory laws that protect people of any sexual orientation. All this information is derived from a paper called State-Sponsored Homophobia 2016, a world survey of sexual orientation laws, criminalization, protection, and recognition. Get educated. Happy Pride, everyone.